Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Roger Marzullo, appearing on behalf of the appellants. Today I'd like to address three points. The first is that the economic analysis performed in this case does not comport with the statute. Second, that the rule violates the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA. And third, that the evidence does not support the finding that the property was occupied by the endangered species. Turning first to the economic analysis, it's clear that Congress knew that the designation of critical habitat could have a significant economic impact upon the owner of property. Therefore, Congress required that that economic impact be analyzed prior to the designation of property as endangered species habitat. In this case, the rule to be applied in performing that economic analysis was set out by Judge Wilson of the Central District of California in an order to the agency requiring the use of the coextensive methodology. On remand, the agency failed to use the coextensive
methodology. Things have changed on remand, right?
Things did not change,
well,
really.
The Ninth Circuit, the underlying rule changed, and then the Ninth Circuit decision came along as well.
There is a case pointed to by the government which deals, Your Honor, not with the requirement. It's not an economic analysis case. It is a case dealing with the nature of the designation and how that designation is to be gone about. It is true that you may stack the fact that the Tenth Circuit cited to the existing rule of the agency as a basis for why coextensive methodology was the methodology that should be used.
As I understand, the Tenth Circuit was saying, look, baseline analysis just doesn't adequately account for the costs that come that need to be looked at for critical habitat designation. The service changed their analysis in the Tenth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit pointed the direction saying that now baseline works, right?
I don't think that's...
And other circuits have said the same. Baseline is now, it's a different form of analysis in that sense than it was when you were looking at the district court.
The Ninth Circuit has now said that in Arizona cattle raisers. Absolutely, Your Honor. And clearly, the government's remedy was to go back to the district court and to say to the district court in a Rule 60B motion, the law has changed, Your Honor. Please modify your order. What's happened here, and the agency claims deference to its legal analysis of the state of affairs. I think there's a significant question, Your Honor, as to whether or not the order of Judge Wilson is lawful or unlawful, and I think that is the key question here. The agency has not made the argument that Your Honor has made.
I haven't seen that in your brief.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I haven't seen that argument in your brief, that Judge Wilson's order was unlawful.
No. I say if the agency felt that Judge Wilson's, I understood Your Honor's argument to be that.
I don't have an argument, Kelly.
No.
Question.
I'm sorry. The question to be, now that 2 months ago the Ninth Circuit has decided Arizona cattle growers, doesn't that pull the rug out from under Judge Wilson's order?
And I my think response. The government's argument, though, following up on Judge Griffith's questions, was the agency changed the underlying analysis on which the Tenth Circuit relied.
I don't think that's true, Your Honor. The
well,
agency
they argue that in their brief.
In fact, the district judge asked the agency, "Have you rescinded the regulation that the Ninth Circuit invalidated in Gifford-Pinchot?" And the answer was, no, we have not rescinded. That regulation is still there, and it is still followed in the Tenth Circuit.
Was the guidance changed?
There is some guidance that I think probably has changed. But the importance of that, Your Honor, is that the agency begs that this court give it deference to the legal analysis of the solicitor's office. The real question here, the hanging question, I think, is does Judge Wilson's order, is the agency free to simply disregard Judge Wilson's order, or should it have gone back to Judge Wilson and asked for a modification of that order? Is the agency free to make up for its own mind its legal analysis that Judge Wilson's order is no longer valid. There are two other reasons, at least, why that economic analysis doesn't give the agency the information that Congress requires in order to make this designation. A key one is that the subject property was not included in the original 2003 analysis, and that as of the date of designation, there simply was no economic information about the economic impact on this particular property.
Let me ask you, can you point to me where in the record I can find that? I spent some time trying to find your client's property, and I see a couple of places it's listed, but I didn't see anything that supported your claim that your client's property was not included in that 2003-2004 analysis.
Your Honor, we did cite a chart, but I think the key point is there was a chart that excluded from actual designation, from the proposal to designate, areas that were within the multi-species conservation plan. But I'm actually making a more narrow point here, I think. And that is, if
so
you look...
There's no place in the record I can find support for your claim that your client...
Oh, there is, Your Honor, and
well,
I will have that record site.
Maybe on rebuttal you can give it to me, because I just have to say, it seems to me that at least I wanted to know where the property was, where it's situated, what its relationship is to the sightings, et cetera. And it's not easy to find that in the record.
Yes. Well, I apologize for that, Your Honor. The point I was going to make, however, is this, that the agency admits that all but about $153,000 of the $53 million original economic impact analyzed here is in the Los Angeles and Orange County management area. Those are areas, I can tell you, far distant from San Diego County, which is where this property is located, 50 or 100 miles away. I don't think the agency can point to any cost that it attributed to this property at all, whether or not it was included in 2003. They simply said, well, there's no cost.
So in this 20-odd thousand acres that was looked at, your client's property is not in there?
20,000 acres would have been, I think, Your Honor, the very original
analysis. That's right.
Before 2000.
Not in the 2003-2004
economic analysis.
Yep.
That's correct. Areas within the multi-species conservation plan were originally deemed essential, but then they were excluded because they were under this joint state-federal program, so they were already protected. The agency said, okay, we don't need to include them and designate them as critical habitat because there is an entirely different regime that we've set up for that fundamentally delegates to the county the authority to do the consultations and come up with permits. But the other point, as I said, is the agency admits it's 202 acres that they considered. That did not include the 143 acres of our client's property. That property was in a different county. And finally, the shortcut, the 44%, simply has no basis. It's an arbitrary number. And if they were going to use the baseline method, they should have done it correctly. I think that's our point. And that means they should have figured out what is the baseline cost.
Am I right that you didn't raise these challenges to the merits of the economic analysis until the supplemental briefing in summary judgment before the district court? That's the first time that you made this argument, this sort of preclusion argument about being bound by what Judge Wilson said. But the argument we're hearing now was not raised until the supplemental briefing. Isn't that correct?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
So what are we to make of that? Isn't that a little late?
Well, the district court asked us to brief this very issue, and we briefed it, and the district court decided it. It seems to me that any complaint the government might have had about that procedure should have been addressed to the district judge. If they felt it was inappropriate to brief the issue, it seems to me they should have raised it. And I don't see them arguing in their brief that it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to ask for supplemental briefing on this issue.
Yeah.
As to NEPA, I will only say that the government doesn't defend failure to do NEPA analysis here. They simply say that we lack standing.
Is the prudential standing issue here? How are your clients harmed in an environmental way? They have to have an environmental interest that's hurt here. What's the environmental interest?
We do. There's one more word in NEPA, Your Honor.
Yeah.
It is impact on the human environment. And, of course, a great many cases have identified community interests, things such as the infrastructure here. This property is situated in a very critical and strategic place,
right,
in that it is on the border of Mexico. There is planned a major border crossing with all of the...
It's a major commercial area if you succeed. I understand that.
That
gives you standing to challenge the failure to...
No, that was not my point, Your Honor. My point is that the federal government is creating, has issued a presidential permit and is creating a major border crossing between the United States and Mexico. That is a public project, not my client's project. There are major gas and electrical conduits on this property which provide power and energy to the eastern part of San Diego County. They are impacted. There is a major landfill, which will be the principal landfill for eastern San Diego County, which will be impacted by those designations. Now, yes, of course my client has an economic interest in those, but
right,
so but do the people of San Diego County.
How do you distinguish our line of cases saying you have to show environmental harm?
Well, that's what I'm saying. The human environment, Your Honor, includes the community. Clearly,
the way our cases have written it, I mean, when you talk about economic harm, our cases have said that's not sufficient.
No, that's what I'm saying. That Realty Investment Trust versus Eckhart, which is a case we've cited from this court, has a the owner of an apartment an office building who is found to have standing with respect to increased traffic that will result due to
noise.
Other noise, traffic, due to construction in the neighborhood.
So the human impact is what here, other than economic?
It is the impact on the public facilities that are planned for this area, the third border crossing, the electrical and gas conduits, and the landfill, all of which are community services.
Don't we normally find standing when somebody is challenging them, saying that those are negative things? These are things that you want to go forward, I presume, right?
Yes, but I don't think that's the test, Your Honor. I think the test is, is this simply money in my client's pocket and nobody in the community cares, or is this going to impact the community? And I think what we are saying is this designation is going to impact the plans of the federal government with respect to the third border crossing, the plans of the power companies with respect to supplying power and energy.
And our clients can have standing to raise all these interests?
Those are the kinds of things customarily studied in an environmental impact statement, Your Honor. One of the issues you look at is how is this going to affect the people in the community? And if it's going to affect their power supply...
Do your clients have standing to bring that on behalf of the community?
The question was whether my clients are within the zone of interest. That is, whether these issues are within the zone of interest of NEPA. That's what I was addressing. NEPA does concern itself with the houses and businesses in the community and how they're going to be impacted by this designation, insofar as it relates to these public and community services.
I mean, you'd expect the county to be in here arguing. In any event, their third point was insufficient.
As to occupied, and I think that's a very simple one, Your Honor. We really have only one verified sighting of four fairy shrimp in 2001 in a road rut on a fairly heavily traveled road. That is regularly...
I'm puzzled by the dimensions of this road rut. When I think of a road rut, I'm thinking of a tire track. This is 9x4? I mean, how does it get so big?
I suspect it is just from the repeated use, Your Honor. I honestly don't know. I have no more information than you do. I do know that the Border Patrol has off-road vehicles and SUVs and so forth, and this is...
And that's your surmise as to how these fairy shrimp got there, right? Got to Pool 5.
It's a surmise, but I think how they got there is not really the big issue. The question is this really habitat? It's still there.
How many sightings would be enough?
I think that depends on the circumstances of the case. Here, what we know is Congress requires that it be occupied in 1997 at the time of the listing, and I think you would need some evidence that would relate back. Frankly, if fairy shrimp had been identified...
What do you mean evidence that would relate back? They've given a reason why it relates back, and it sounds like a pretty good reason, right? I mean, the science, the biology, I guess it would be the science about the physical movement of these fairy shrimp suggests that they don't migrate, that if they were there in 2001, it's reasonable that they would be there in 1997. You don't dispute that, do you?
The dispute, yes, I'm afraid we do, because there was no road rut. The road rut still lasts that long.
You don't dispute the characterization that these fairy shrimp don't migrate.
No, absolutely. They don't migrate. No, what we're saying is that the thing, as you know, they're kind of like these sea monkeys that children get, the brine shrimp, and you put water on them and they come to life. What we are saying is there's no evidence to show I think, quite unlikely that that road rut was there in 1997 and that there were fairy shrimp in that road rut. You would have thought that they'd show up somewhere in all of the other surveys. But the only survey was in this one road rut in a heavily traveled road that, as we've indicated, it's not there anymore.
I thought interveners pointed to some other sightings.
They pointed to sightings that are not on this property, but are on other properties, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. And the only other thing referenced is that the surveyors presumed that they were fairy shrimp in this other pool.
This pool 87? Or
pool 68, Your Honor. Yes.
There's a stream that runs from 68 to pool 5?
Well, I don't think it's a stream. I think what they're saying is that, yeah, it's a pond and that, if it fills up, the water will flow.
68 is a cattle pond, right?
That's
dammed.
Correct.
It's artificial. Does it ever drain?
I don't think, yeah. I'm not even sure it's that artificial, Your Honor. I think it's a big hole in the ground. We're really talking about...
I thought the record talked about it was dammed.
That may be the case. Okay. But in any event, I think the government's argument is that the pool, when it fills up, will overflow. And so if you find fairy shrimp next to the pool in the road rut, then you can surmise that they came from the pool. But it seems to me that's a lot of surmise.
They did find fairy shrimp downstream from there. Am I getting it? Is it pool 87?
No, Your Honor. And I think that was our discussion about the vicinity. Mm-hmm. Geographically, topographically, this land slopes southward toward Mexico.
Right.
They found fairy shrimp to the west.
Southwest,
right? And to the southwest of this property. And that is not in the path of where the water flows from this property. So their argument was, well, this must be watershed. Remembering watershed, what we're talking about here are puddles that are a few inches to maybe a foot or two deep. How much acreage, how many hundreds of acres do you need to fill a puddle of that size?
You said something earlier that it didn't matter so much how it got there. I thought it does matter to your theory how the fairy shrimp got there, in the sense that your theory is that the rut wasn't there most likely in 1997, so it must have come in. What is your theory as to?
You're certainly correct, Your Honor, in this sense. I think you have to have the rut before you have the fairy shrimp. The fairy shrimp do not survive on, flat ground.
Right. So the rut is created after 97, is your theory?
Yes. I think that would be correct, Your Honor, that because these roads are regularly maintained and graded each year so that the Border Patrol can use them daily to interdict aliens crossing the border, and there are literally hundreds of aliens coming across this property daily, sometime between 1997 and 2001, this rut was created, probably in 2001, in calendar year, well, this was January, so I guess in late 2000, early 2001, this rut was created, it rained, it filled up, and the fairy shrimp probably got there on a tire.
Are you thinking they were brought in on the tire?
I think that's the most likely explanation, Your Honor.
Is there any scientific support for that as distinct from the scientific support the government has?
Well, the government's scientific support, Your Honor, is...
No, but the nature of the soils, the nature of the water...
Oh, yeah, we don't disagree on the nature of the soils.
Right.
I think it's a stretch to call a rut in a dirt road a vernal pool, because vernal pools...
Well, you said the cattle thing is just a hole in the ground. That's what...
Yeah, well, but vernal pools are usually defined by certain kinds of plants as well, and other small animals similar to these.
Why don't we hear from the government?
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll give you a few minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Maggie Smith, and I'm here on behalf of the United States Department of the Interior. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for the intervener in this case. I'd like to start off this discussion by answering Judge Rogers' question about where this property is and the topography of the area.
Can you just tell me where I can find that the best?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I would point you to page 359 of the joint appendix.
All right, I have looked at that. That's the best one, you think?
That's a map that shows where in unit, subunit 5D, right, the properties are. And then I think if you compare that with page 216, which is one of the very large maps.
Right.
And you look in the lower right-hand corner of that map, you can see subunit 5D on the map.
Right. I found all that. And what I'm trying to pin down is the argument is their client's property, you know, has been off to the side. It hasn't been in the surveys. It hasn't been in the economic analysis, and those two places you say will show me exactly where the property is and confirm the government's position that this was part of the economic analysis in 2004?
That's right. If you compare those maps to the map on page 31 of the addendum that we provided the court, that map shows the 2003 proposed designation, and subunit 5D is clearly visible in the same shape on that map as it is on the map submitted as part of this litigation. And you can see that it was, in fact, a part of subunit 5D. Again, to the extent that there's any dispute about that, the plaintiffs in comments to the agency on the proposed designation provided, as part of their comments on the 2003 proposed designation, a map showing the proposed subunit 5D and in pink where their properties were located on that map. I think it's
right,
sort of beyond dispute that they were in fact part of the 2003 proposed designation. The other important thing about where this property is that it is the far easternmost section of subunit 5D against the foothills of the San Ysidro Mountains. The arguments that the plaintiffs make regarding Pool 87 are just factually incorrect. Pool 87 lies on the Mexican border. It is to the southwest of the property. There is nothing to the east of the property because it runs into the mountain range, which is not suitable vernal pool formation area.
Why is so much land to the east of Pool 68 designated? There are vernal ponds there, but they've never found any fairy shrimp there. There doesn't seem to be any connection between the area to the east and 68 and 5. So why so much?
The area to the east is a higher elevation than the area to the west. So those sections of the property that are designated are part of the watershed for the pools where prairie shrimp has been found. That's Pool 87, Pool 5, and Pool 68. It's all sort of part of the same basin.
The east is part of the watershed for 68 and 5 and 87?
And 87, that's right. All of that water flows to the southwest, and that's how the pools are filled, and that provides the impermeable soil that allows for this type of water collection.
But there haven't been any findings of fairy shrimp in that area to the east, right?
No.
In fact, the only finding of fairy shrimp here are the four instances in the tire rut. That's it.
That's not the case. They were identified in Pool 68 by...
Not as fairy shrimp.
They were identified as Branchonecta, and the surveyor, who is a qualified expert in this area, determined that they were, in fact, San Diego fairy shrimp. And...
At the time of the study or later?
That's right, at the time. If you look at the report that was submitted, that was then the EDAW support that we cite to in our brief, it concludes that those were in fact San Diego fairy shrimp. And there were a couple of good reasons for that. The first is that there is this connection between Pool 5 and Pool 68. The second is that Branchonecta are a particular genre of fairy shrimp. They look quite different than other genre of fairy shrimp. And San Diego fairy shrimp are the only type of Branchonecta that's found in this area of the Otay Mesa. So it's a reasonable assumption. In any event, it's not been disputed that Pool 87 is occupied by the San Diego fairy shrimp. And because these designated areas of these properties form the watershed for Pool 87, the designation was also justified on that basis. And to answer your question, Judge Griffith, about Pool 5 and why it is so large and how it forms, and this entire area is a remnant vernal pool complex. At one time, vernal pools covered much of this area. So pool formation in this area, when you drive a car or a truck, you know, through a dirt road, the pools tend to form very easily, or were in fact former pools that are just now have a road running through them. So that's why the road ruts look the way they do and function the way they do, because they truly do function as a natural, untouched vernal pool would function. I'd also just like to say,
as the Pool 5 alone, if we're just thinking about that, a single sighting in 2001 can make it occupied?
That's right. I mean, I think as
that
the district...
That seems, a stretch.
I think as the district court pointed out in this case, fairy shrimp are not great travelers. Generally, if they're found in a pool, that
means...
The court
also said it was distinctly thin evidence.
That's right.
Distinctly thin. That's pretty strong language.
We would disagree with that characterization for the reasons that I just discussed. But to go back to the one sighting... The one sighting is exactly what we would expect to find based on the life history of San Diego fairy shrimp. They only appear for about 30 days. So if you sample and you find...
What if it came in on a tire?
I mean, there's just no evidence in the record that's the case, particularly given
There's no evidence in the record to support the idea that it was there back in 1997.
In Pool 5, as we explained in our brief, the evidence indicates that this was an occupied vernal pool complex. I think whether Pool 5 itself existed is sort of misses.
You're linking it all to 87, right? I mean, that your strongest argument is
68 and Pool 5. But I mean, I think 87 is. Is there, and it is indisputably occupied, and this property is part of the watershed for Pool 87. But it's the service in this case that's the expert agency that looks at the scientific evidence and has to make a determination based on the scientific evidence available to it whether or not the pool is occupied. Now, just to be clear,
its job is to do the scientific evidence, but the term occupied, we have a role in interpreting. And occupied implies, to me at least, something more than a single sighting. Occupied implies not a temporary sighting.
Again, based on the life history of this species, one would not have expected to see more than a single sighting. And that's because there were no...
Well, can you elaborate on that? I don't understand that.
First of all, the only surveys that we have of this property were in 2001.
There were 8 of them, right?
They kept returning to that area, but again, they observed adult fairy shrimp, and they did not return to those pools for weeks afterwards. And based on the life history of this species, you would expect that they would have already died and gone to the bottom and become mired in the muck within a couple of weeks after the first sighting.
They've all died. How's it still occupied?
Well, this is kind of the cool thing about how fairy shrimp function, is that when they die, they carry their eggs with them, and they sink to the bottom of the pool. They become mired in the muck. The pool may dry out. It may be exposed to intense heat, intense cold. But when the rains come again and refill the pool, those cysts, those eggs, will hatch again.
Right, so you should find them again.
If you went back and sampled, but the agency
didn't go back and sample.
That's right, because, ideally... I'm sure the agency would love to sample, but no, it's not a problem, because the Endangered Species Act instructs the service to make the designation on the basis of the best scientific evidence available.
Are there other cases like this where the agency's done something based on a single sighting of something of this nature?
It just seems that
occupied would be a much more common sense application than this, and it just strikes me. I understand your point about the other pools and what have you, and I understand your point about the agency as the expert. I get all that, and we'll take that into account. But still, occupied, this doesn't fit the common sense understanding of occupied.
That's why, isn't your better argument that this is all watershed for 87? Why are you putting so much emphasis on 68, which was questionable, right? It was a surmise, and 5, which is problematic at best? Why isn't that your argument?
I mean, I think that is our argument, that it is in pool. It is in pool 8, that pool 87 can serve as a basis. But I also think that when the service has a survey that points to this pool, a documented occurrence of the species in this pool, it's the only time that the only year that this pool has been surveyed, that they are well within reason to determine that that pool is in fact occupied. And I think this species has a very unique life history, that this might, that this is perhaps unique to this species, but that it is sufficient evidence.
How do you answer your opponent's response to our question about prudential standing? He says that environmental means something more than I thought environmental meant.
Right, and again, there's no case law that takes the broad environmental view, view of what an environmental harm is that the plaintiffs are asserting here. But even if they were correct, they haven't alleged any sort of environmental injury connected to any of these proposed projects. I think that this court's decision in Town of Stratford is particularly on point here, where the town alleged that because of the project, travel time on Main Street was going to increase by 1 minute per trip. But because they didn't link that to any sort of environmental injury, it was insufficient to confer prudential standing on the town. Here, again, there are absolutely no allegations of environmental injury in any of the affidavits, and there's nothing to support a finding of standing.
So you couldn't distinguish our precedent on the grounds that we weren't addressing this other phrase in NEPA about, that appellants are focusing on?
The human environment.
Yeah.
I think that the things that they're alleging, and I mean, one could imagine an environmental injury that could somehow stem from one of them. So but there aren't any environmental injuries here. I mean, I think you have to look at the affidavit specifically and see what they're alleging. And in particular, some of these, the garbage dump, for example, this area was surveyed for a garbage dump 20 years ago. There are no plans to site a garbage dump here at this time. I mean, it's not sufficient for environmental injury.
On Pool 87, in the reply brief, they say that none of the subject, because none of the subject property is located north of Pool 87, it cannot serve as watershed for Pool 87 because the water flows away from, not toward, Pool 87.
I mean, if that were true, this would be an entirely different case because their property would actually have to be in Mexico for that to be true. Again, Pool 87 sits on the Mexican border. And the maps speak for themselves.
Am I right? Isn't there a stream that goes from 68 to 87?
There's a stream that's visible on the aerial photographs of the area traveling from 68 to 87. And I can see that I've exceeded my time, so unless there are any questions.
Do you want to respond to the first argument, which counsel for appellant said is the key argument, whether the agency violated the district court's order?
Sure. Well, first of all, even assuming that that order is enforceable in this court, the agency did comply with it. The court in NRDC said that the agency should redo the economic analysis in light of the principles articulated in New Mexico Cattle Growers. As this court seems to understand, the rationale of New Mexico Cattle Growers was completely erased by the decision in Gifford Pinchot and the guidance that the service issued that gave a new meaning to the term adverse modification.
So the regulation itself was never modified. It was just that the guidance was reinterpreting the regulation?
No, the regulation, the guidance says that the regulation is not to be relied upon, that it is no longer operative for adverse modification, and that now the service must consider the value of recovery of critical habitat when making a critical habitat designation. This creates sort of a gap between the jeopardy regulation and the adverse modification regulation that erases this problem that the court in New Mexico Cattle Growers had identified, that the economic impact of designating an area would always be zero. I mean, that was what the Tenth Circuit was concerned about, and because of this regulatory change, that is no longer the case.
And also, if we dig back into the previous rulemakings that are referenced in the final rule, will we see that this economic analysis does take into account more than Los Angeles County?
Yes, and we specifically cite to those areas in our brief where that I think this property is part of unincorporated San Diego County, and unincorporated San Diego County is referenced specifically as part of the Southern Coastal Mesa Management Zone, and you know, as we explain again in our brief, the cost of designation in this area was a lot lower than in some of the other areas because the County of San Diego has such strict regulations regarding development. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't considered.
The unincorporated part.
It's an unincorporated, yes.
And those regulations apply there?
Yes.
Oh. Interesting. All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
My name is William Snape, counsel for the interveners. Despite some of the challenging facts that we've talked about, this is actually a very straightforward case. It's a case about scientific deference to the agency based upon the evidence in the record. And I think that the plaintiff's appellants are playing a game of gotcha, and I'd like to address some of the issues that I've heard over the last 20 minutes and try to put some light on it. Critical habitat is statutorily only mentioned in three parts of the Endangered Species Act. It's mentioned in Section 3.5 in the definition section. It's mentioned in Section 4, which is actually how the critical habitat is designated. And then it's operative only through one section. That's Section 7, the consultation provision, the interagency consultation provision. And there are a couple interesting points about these three sections of critical habitat in the statute. The first is the only way in which critical habitat will be an issue for these private landowners is if they need some sort of authorization from a federal agency. I have not seen any allegation of that in the pleadings. Perhaps I missed it, but this is not just, critical habitat does not statutorily apply directly to private property. There must be a federal agency nexus during the consultation process. The other thing that's interesting, this goes to Judge Kavanaugh's question about the one sighting or the not that very many sightings, which is that for both occupied and unoccupied critical habitat under the statute, the standard is the same, which is essential to the conservation of the species. And it seems to me, particularly in a case like this, where this is a unique species, very much dependent upon water in a very drought-infected area. Southeast California is one of the driest areas in the United States. So, Your Honor, Judge Kavanaugh particularly, who asked the question, I don't think it's that unusual in this context to not see a fairy shrimp for upwards of a decade. In fact, the home builder's Ninth Circuit case, which talked about other fairy shrimp and other vernal pools in a different context, talks about that is the phenomenon of fairy shrimp and vernal pools, is that they come and they go, and there's sometimes long periods of time.
It's odd to talk about something being occupied when you don't see it for a decade.
I grant you that is a unique fact, but it is consistent.
And the reason it's of concern, of course, is because there's a substantial interest on both sides of this, which Congress was trying to strike the balance between the environment and the economic interests. And so we need to make sure that occupied has some support in the record. And so not seeing something for 10 years is tough to square with the term occupied.
That's understandable, Your Honor. And I just want to point out, as it relates to that, is the scientific standard under the Endangered Species Act, the legal standard, is best scientific data available. I agree with you. This data is not the most impressive data ever, but it is the best available scientific data that was in the record, and I believe that the service rationally relied upon that scientific evidence.
You say it was the best scientific evidence available. Wasn't it the only?
Yes.
Does that mean it's the best?
Yes.
If it's the only, is it the best?
It is, and I think in this case, Your Honor, when you look at the facts...
What if it's poor data? What if it's poor science?
Well, I think then this court would have the opportunity to say that that's arbitrary and capricious. But in the area at issue, the specific geographic area at issue, the service went back to the area in 2003. It's in the record. Yeah. They had heard these complaints. They had heard these concerns. They went back and they surveyed, and it had all the primary constituent elements, all the habitat elements that you would expect for a San Diego fairy shrimp. I think it's a very rational conclusion, and there's no evidence that rebuts it. Yes?
No shrimp, right?
Well, no shrimp, but they found the shrimp, you know, within the last decade, which was very much within the normal range of when you would see the species. The last point I'd like to make about NEPA is, very quickly, and I agree with everything my colleague from the Justice Department said, is whether NEPA applies to critical habitat is a big deal. And there's a split in the circuits between the Ninth and the Tenth Circuit. I think this circuit has leaned towards, although it's not dispositively said that NEPA doesn't apply to critical habitat designations. But my point is this. Whatever you want to say about whether plaintiffs, appellants, pleading passed legal muster, it was not pled well. If this is an issue that this court wants to address, I think we need much more a focus on that issue. The district court didn't even address it. I think it would... Everything the Justice Department said is true. I just think to go down the NEPA road, given how this was pleaded, would create a lot of problems, and I would urge the court not to go there in this instance.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I will be brief. First of all, I have great respect for Mr. Snape, but his statement that not seeing fairy shrimp for a decade is not unusual, is nowhere supported in the record. Second, counsel referred to their reference to an amount. The amount actually is $155,000 that was shown as the economic cost of this whole management area. And if you read the description of that, it's the cost that will be spent by Fish and Wildlife Service in the process of consultation. It says nothing about economic impact to the property owner. Now, Your Honor, Judge Roberts asked for some citations. On page appendix 254, this is relating to the exclusion in 2003. Page 254 is the discussion from the Federal Register that in which the government indicates that in 2003 they excluded this area, including Section 5D, within which this property is located, because of the multi-species conservation plan, and that as a result of the district court's decision in Southwest Biodiversity versus Bartles, that they are now including it. And on page 257, you'll find the chart that they used, which compares the designations in each of the three critical years, 2003, 2007. Under 5D, it says excluded, deemed essential but excluded in 2003 and included in 2007.
All right, that's, what site was that, the second one?
That's Appendix 257, Your Honor.
Thank you. Anything further?
There's been a great deal of discussion about Pool 87. Measuring the map that we've all been referring to, it looks like that's about 3,000 feet, maybe from the subject pools, Pool 68 and Pool 5. Council looks to, when counsel for the government told you, and again, we're getting to learn a lot about fairy shrimp, that that's the only fairy shrimp found in the area. What she cites to is a field sheet where some surveyor wrote with respect to Pool 87, it's San Diego fairy, I think it's San Diego fairy shrimp because it's the only fairy shrimp found in the area, meaning the area of Pool 87. There's no evidence in the record that San Diego fairy shrimp is the only one found in this area. And in fact, we know that in Pool 68, they found riverside fairy shrimp. Once again, one more point about fairy shrimp, and then I'll let that topic go. Council has, counsel for the government based a significant part of her argument on the idea that they're only there for 30 days. That's not what the Federal Register says. If you look at 62 Federal Register 496, what it says is an individual fairy shrimp lasts for 30 days, but that as long as the pool is wet, they will continue to hatch, and you would expect to continue to find fairy shrimp in that vernal pool. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.